This is Healthline, a joint venture of WTIC News Talk 1080 and Yale Cancer Center. Yale Cancer Center is a resource for cancer programs throughout Connecticut, developing new advances in prevention, screening, diagnosis, and treatment. On Healthline, you'll hear from some of the leading doctors in the country. Healthline is not intended to provide medical advice. Yale Cancer Center urges you to consult with a qualified physician in your community for diagnosis and for answers to your medical questions. And now, our co-hosts, oncologists Ken Miller and Ed Chu.
Good morning and welcome to Healthline. My name is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm the director of the Survivorship Program at the Yale Cancer Center in New Haven. I'm here in the WTIC studios with my colleague and co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, who's the chief adult oncologist at the Yale Cancer Center. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Ken. Healthline with the Yale Cancer Center is our way of providing you with the most up-to-date information on cancer care every Sunday morning at 8:30 a.m. here on this station, WTIC News Talk 1080. Our Healthline program features some of the nation's leading oncologists and cancer specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer right here in our state of Connecticut.
Each week, Ed and I will be joined by a different expert from the Yale Cancer Center. Together, we will discuss the myths about cancer, the latest treatment available to people with cancer, and advances in clinical research. Our goal is to give you help by providing information, but also to give you hope. We will answer your questions and give you the latest information that we have. If you'd like to submit a question to us or to our guests, you can email us at healthline@yale.edu, or you can call 1-888-234-4YCC. And we will repeat this later. And we'll try to answer your questions online either today or on a different program.
Today, our program focuses on recent treatment advances for ovarian cancer, and it's my great pleasure to introduce our special guest today, who is Dr. Peter Schwartz, the John Slade Eli Professor and Vice Chair of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at the Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Schwartz is one of the nation's leading experts in the treatment of ovarian cancer. Peter, thanks so much for being with us today on Healthline.
Thank you very much, Ed.
Peter, I wanted to start out by asking you, how common is the diagnosis of ovarian cancer?
Well, in the United States, ovarian cancer is generally ascribed to be the fifth most common site that women develop cancer, and it's the fourth most common cause of death from cancer in women in the United States.
Maybe just to help our listening audience, Peter, what is ovarian cancer, and what does it involve?
Okay. Ovarian cancer is a disease that starts on the surface of the outside of the ovary. It can grow locally and invade the local tissues that are in the pelvis, and it can spread around the abdominal cavity and into the lymphatic system. Unlike other tumors such as breast, colon, or lung cancer, it doesn't spread through the bloodstream. So patients with ovarian cancer develop symptoms related to the pelvis and to the abdominal cavity, and the disease tends to stay in those areas throughout the patient's lifespan with the disease.
So following up on that, what are some of the typical symptoms that a woman might complain about?
Well, a number of years ago, it was thought that this was the silent disease, that there were no symptoms associated with ovarian cancer. But starting in about the year 2000, based on a survey that was done of 1,700 American and Canadian women, it's clear ovarian cancer is associated with symptoms, and they're subtle, and they're easy to be confused with other problems. Typically, abdominal bloating, distension, vague, nonspecific abdominal complaints, urinary frequency, those are the symptoms that women get. And the problem is that they can easily be confused with irritable bowel syndrome. About 20% of Americans have irritable bowel syndrome, but only about 25,000 women get ovarian cancer each year. So that's a huge difference, and it's easy for the patient to ascribe the symptoms to be due to something unrelated to the reproductive tract. The ovaries themselves don't cause pain. It's easy for the doctor to ascribe the problems to be due to something other than the reproductive tract.
And if a woman should experience any of the symptoms that you've just described, who should they seek medical attention?
Well, many women use obstetrician-gynecologists as primary care physicians, particularly when they're still in the reproductive age. But I think that when once a woman gets into the postmenopausal era, there's a tendency to shift to primary care doctors, internists, and family docs. If a patient has unexplained abdominal discomfort that persists more than about 2 weeks, pelvic pain, pressure on the bladder so they have urinary frequency, they must demand a pelvic examination to begin the evaluation for possible ovarian cancer.
some of these symptoms are for women who where the ovarian cancer has become very, very evident. There may be a tumor there that's putting pressure on the bladder. But is there a way to screen for earlier detection?
The screening process is really not well developed. About 5 to 10% of American women will have an inherited susceptibility toward ovarian cancer. So based on family histories, a number of sites, Yale included, had set up early ovarian cancer detection programs. Ours was one of the first, if not the first, in the United States. We look for women who have first-degree relatives, mothers, sisters, or God forbid, daughters with ovarian cancer, and that makes them eligible for the program. There's a National Cancer Institute program that is directed through the Gynecologic Oncology Group that we are the number two contributor in terms of patients. But in general, if you're not in a family syndrome where there's a lot of women with breast and some with ovarian cancer, it can be difficult to recognize whether or not you're at an increased risk for the disease. We did a study in Connecticut. We looked in the seven largest hospitals over a two-year period of time. The women at highest risk were Caucasians. There was no non-Caucasian women in any of those hospitals during that time period with ovarian cancer. The second greatest risk was having a first-degree relative with ovarian cancer. In that study, the risk was 18-fold higher. We now know through national studies it's about 3.5-fold higher than those who don't have such relatives. We know that having children has something to do with reducing your risk for ovarian cancer. So a woman with no children in Connecticut has 5 times the risk of someone with 5 or more children. Someone with 1 or 2 children has twice the risk.
All right, I want to ask you, because people sometimes, whether they've had cancer or they've had a relative with cancer, say, why did this happen? Are there any environmental factors, dietary factors, and are there any that increase the risk? And along those lines, is there anything that women can do to reduce their risk?
Okay. To begin with, we don't recognize any particular dietary factors. There had been studies years ago looking at breast cancer patients, and whenever there are breast cancer studies, there's always a spin-off ovarian study. There was one that suggested a high lactose intake may be associated with the development of the cancer. It's never really been borne out. What we know is what are the factors that can reduce the incidence of ovarian cancer in the population as a whole. And the major factor is reducing the number of ovulatory cycles a woman experiences in her lifetime. And that can be accomplished in a variety of ways. First is having children. When you're pregnant, you don't ovulate. Second is breastfeeding. People talk about the benefits to the child regarding breastfeeding. There's a tremendous benefit to the mother. When a mother breastfeeds, she also doesn't ovulate, so you prolong that period of anovulation. The third way to reduce your risk is to use birth control pills, particularly for 5 or more years. Birth control pills work by telling the brain the ovary's making plenty of hormone. It doesn't have to stimulate the ovary to release eggs. So there are hormonal ways to reduce ovulation, and they seem to reduce the risk of ovarian cancer significantly. And then the final way, based on some small studies and then the very large Nurses' Health study, was to have a tubal ligation. We don't understand the mechanism. I have a lot of thoughts about it if you want to hear them, but basically interrupting that passageway between the outside and the inside also reduces the risk of ovarian cancer significantly.
Are there any dietary interventions, Peter, that have been shown to be effective in perhaps reducing the risk?
Not to my knowledge, although people have looked at reducing animal fat in your diet as one way of doing it, it's not clear that that really works well for ovarian cancer.
All right, so I want to ask if this is a myth or if this is the truth. I've heard women say that if you're over age 65, you don't need a pap smear or a pelvic exam. Is that truth or myth?
I would put that high in the myth category.
Thank you. Go ahead. Okay. Tell us more.
All right. I think that one of the things that comes out very, very clearly throughout the medical records of people is that when we're successful in actually curing people with ovarian cancer is when we find the disease early, when it's confined to the ovary. The pelvic exam is not a terrific way of identifying ovarian cancer early, but when it does, it really saves lives and it cures people. So having the patient go to see her obstetrician gynecologist or a primary care physician, the pap smear after age 65, if you've not had abnormal pap smears in the past, probably isn't crucial. But getting there, getting that pelvic exam, being able to explain symptoms, looking for the being encouraged to get the annual mammogram, being encouraged to get colonoscopy. That's all part of good health care, and that's what we expect our obstetrician gynecologists and our primary care physicians to provide as part of that pelvic exam, that annual pelvic exam.
Good. Well, anyways, we would like to remind you to please email your questions to us at healthline@yale.edu, or you can call us at 1-888-234-4YCC. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about the treatment advances in ovarian cancer with Dr. Peter Schwartz from the Yale Cancer Center.
This is a Medical Minute brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. Breast cancer is the second most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year. But there is a new hope for these women. Earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies provide more options for patients to fight breast cancer. In 2006, more women are learning to live with this disease than ever before. Women should schedule an annual mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with the disease. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, breast cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers such as the Yale Cancer Center to make innovative new treatments which have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration available to patients. For more information, visit their website at yalecancercenter.org. That's yalecancercenter.org.
Well, welcome back to Healthline with the Yale Cancer Center and WTIC. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm in the WTIC studios with my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and our guest, Dr. Peter Schwartz, who's an expert in the treatment of ovarian cancer.
Peter, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the potential role of pap smear in screening. I'm wondering if maybe you could elaborate a bit more on what are some of the screening methods that are currently being recommended to see if women might have ovarian cancer.
Sure. The National Cancer Institute has come across with some policy statements recommending that women only undergo ovarian cancer screening because of their they have a strong family history of ovarian and breast cancer. There are only two routine tests available now that people are using to try to identify ovarian cancer early. One is ultrasound, usually done by the endovaginal route, and the other is CA125. That's a blood test that measures a protein in a bloodstream. The problem with the CA125 is that it can be elevated for a lot of benign gynecologic conditions, and it's also elevated in things like liver disease, heart disease. We've had somebody with overactive thyroid that had excessive fluid. It is not specific. It probably would work better in, or it definitely works better in postmenopausal women where the benign gynecologic problems are not going to interfere with the test.
Now, Peter, I understand your group here at Yale has really been at the forefront of trying to develop some new serum markers that might be able to detect ovarian cancer at an earlier stage. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on that.
Yes, we have a Discovery to Cure program, and it starts with basic science research. We then go into a translational research lab, and finally we apply it to the patients who are participating in our research programs. Dr. Gil Moore, an MD, PhD in our gynecologic oncology laboratory, has looked at both proteins associated with inflammation in the bloodstream and proteins associated with cancer. He's been able to identify a profile of four proteins that are either excessive or underexpressed in the bloodstream. The outcome has been that after a series of studies, this is now going to a national trial. LabCorp has taken up a patent on it. The NCI is also studying this through the early detection the National Early Detection Program, and we're very excited about this as possibly a marker for early detection of ovarian cancer.
It sounds like it'll be a wonderful advance if there's a way to find the disease earlier. Yep. I want to read you an email that we received from Judy, who lives in Terryville. She says, "My doctor found a cyst on my ovary, and she has two questions. How can I feel confident that this is not cancer?" And her other question is, does a cyst put me at higher risk of developing ovarian cancer?
Well, if you're in the reproductive age, we know that cysts are very common. So what we want to know is what this cyst look like. And usually the doc finds it because he or she has done an ultrasound. If the cyst looks like a simple cyst, a thin-walled cyst, like a balloon filled with water, that's benign. If it has multiple solid and cystic elements in the tumor, that's when we get worried about problems. But in the younger age women, endometriosis can give you false positives, and a variety of benign ovarian cysts can give you that appearance. In the postmenopausal women, cysts less than 5 centimeters are very common. It's estimated that 20% of women age 60 will have ovarian cysts if you look hard enough for them. The overwhelming majority will be less than 3 centimeters in diameter. Again, if those cysts look like a balloon filled with water, that's benign.
Do those pose a risk of turning into cancer? Is one of the questions she had.
Yeah, we have no knowledge that those simple cysts ever turn into cancer. One of the real problems with ovarian cancer is that we don't recognize a precancerous phase. It's not like with cervical cancer where you do a pap smear to pick up the precancerous changes, or even breast cancer where there are precancerous changes. Ovary doesn't express that, at least we haven't recognized it.
Great. Peter, we have, I think, a very interesting email from Chris in Orange, and she writes, "My mother and grandmother are both ovarian cancer survivors, and I've read that women with a strong genetic link to ovarian cancer may choose to have their ovaries removed in an effort to prevent the disease. Is this recommended?"
It is recommended, but probably some further evaluation for Chris would really be appropriate. There is a test called looking for genetic mutations in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene, and Chris has a 50% chance of having inherited one of those two mutations if the family, her mom or grandmother, have one of those mutations. Chris's direction as far as being followed versus prophylactic oophorectomy should be based on further evaluation.
Okay, great. Thanks. And maybe just for our listening audience, I think it's important to note that we have a very superb genetic counseling office led by Ellen Matloff at the Yale Cancer Center. And obviously, you know, a woman in this category really should probably seek genetic counseling. Wouldn't you say so, Peter?
Yes. As part of our own early ovarian cancer detection program, Chris would be qualified. And Ellen would be somebody that we would be sending Chris to for the genetic counseling part of it.
Well, again, we'd like to remind you to please email us your questions at healthline@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break to listen to a survivor's story. And please stay tuned to learn more information about ovarian cancer with Dr. Peter Schwartz.
A few years ago, the diagnosis of cancer was a death sentence for many patients. But today, thanks to advances in clinical research, we're turning the corner in the battle against cancer. There are over 10 million cancer survivors now living in the U.S. They are the true heroes in the war against cancer. Here's the story of a hero from Fairfield.
I visited a walk-in clinic on Christmas Eve in 1999 because I thought I had the flu. The doctor there suspected that it was something more serious, and as he examined my belly, he found a mass. I was referred to Dr. Tom Rutherford, a gynecologic oncologist and researcher at Yale Cancer Center, where I had surgery and received chemotherapy for stage 2 ovarian cancer. Because of early detection, excellent treatment, and the benefit of the latest research, I recently celebrated 6 years as a cancer survivor. Today, I'm a fervent believer that women should pay attention to changes in their bodies and should not be reluctant to tell their physicians any concerns they have, even those they feel might sound trivial. Early detection is the best way to cure cancer.
This survivor's story has been brought to you by Yale Cancer Center.
Well, welcome back to Healthline. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm in the WTIC studios with my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and our guest, Dr. Peter Schwartz. And we're talking about some of the latest breakthroughs in the treatment of ovarian cancer. Peter, I wanted to ask you, throughout your career and as a gynecologic oncologist, a surgeon, what advances have you seen in terms of surgical treatment of this cancer?
Well, the major advance in surgical treatment of ovarian cancer has to do with the advanced stage diseases. There is no question but that aggressive cytoreductive surgery, meaning making a maximum effort to take out all of the tumor, is now recognized worldwide as the initial first step in the treatment of advanced stage ovarian cancer. That's been the biggest breakthrough, the acceptance of that kind of a surgical procedure.
I'm going to ask you a question that I think women think about when they're diagnosed and sometimes ask, which is this a curable disease when it's advanced?
Well, across the board, it is a curable disease, but where our success rate is highest, of course, is when it's confined to the ovary. Unfortunately, about 70% of women don't have ovarian cancer recognized to be present until it's advanced into the upper abdomen, so-called stage 3 disease. About 70% of our women present with stage 3 or 4 disease. So in that group of women, the standard treatment is aggressive cytoreductive surgery, that cancer surgery I just talked about, followed by intense chemotherapy. And about 20% of the women will be cured. But many women now will live much longer because the other major breakthrough has been the introduction of effective chemotherapy. And we started with the platinum agents back in 1979. We started using that at Yale. And most recently, the introduction of the taxanes has really increased the time period that women will live, even with advanced disease, that is not going to be cured.
Peter, following up on that, earlier this year, I think there was a great deal of attention in the media about a report coming from the gynecology oncology group showing that the use of intraperitoneal chemotherapy added greatly to intravenous chemotherapy. Perhaps you could explain to our listening audience what that means.
Well, giving the chemotherapy into the abdominal cavity, the peritoneal cavity, is the approach that the GOG, the gynecologic oncology group, used in that the third of three trials now that they reported positive results. The concept really is twofold. First, that this cancer doesn't spread through the bloodstream, so that you attack it in the region rather than having to attack the whole body. The second is that you can give much higher doses of chemotherapy into the abdominal cavity, seemingly without causing as much side effects and interruption of or disruption of the quality of life as when you give similar doses intravenously. So what the GOG had done in their initial trial, they had used agents that we don't currently use today as standard therapy, so people kind of disregard the first trial. The second trial, they had given a lot of intense intravenous chemotherapy first and then gave the intraperitoneal, so we kind of disregard that. But in the most recent trial, they gave very intense intraperitoneal chemotherapy along with intravenous cisplatin. And they compared it to cisplatin and Taxol, the two standard drugs given intravenously. They found that the women who had had optimum cytoreduction, that is, they went through that big operation we talked about, they had virtually nothing left behind. They did significantly better than those who did not get the intraperitoneal chemo.
And so based on that study, are you using this approach in patients that you see here at Yale New Haven?
Well, nothing is as simple as it would seem, even in the New England Journal of Medicine. It turns out that a previous gynecologic oncology group study using the standard agents we do use at Yale New Haven intravenously, carboplatin and Taxol, gives an even better survival than the intraperitoneal treatment regimen that was used in the most recent New England Journal of Medicine article. I think we still have to learn the best way to use IP therapy.
I want to ask you about the drug Avastin. And we've talked actually about on this program the use of Avastin in breast cancer and in colon cancer. And it's a very exciting drug. And is that being used in ovarian cancer? How does it work? And is that something that you think is going to add to our armamentarium?
Well, I think with the ovarian cancer, we now have a protocol, first line from the gynecologic oncology group that does use Avastin, and it's used in the women where we can't get all of the cancer out. So that represents a small but a definite group of women. The Avastin is a anti-vascular endothelial growth factor, and it seems to play a role in ovarian cancer. There is a bit of a hedge, however. And that is that at least three of 66 women that were treated in an earlier GOG study with Avastin developed spontaneous bowel perforations. We don't know why this happened, but we do know that they all three had resections of the sigmoid colon. And so there, just as with the IP chemotherapy, one has to be careful in how you select it. It is now being recommended not to be used with the first cycle of this regimen, but be introduced once everything is healed up with the second cycle. But it's still a research drug in the world of ovarian cancer. We still have to define its role.
Peter, what are some of the really exciting clinical trials that your group is trying to develop here at the Yale Cancer Center?
Well, through the Discovery to Cure program, Gil Moore, was able to identify a plant isoflavonoid from Australia that's called phenoxodiol. And it has some wonderful properties, including being able to reverse the resistance of cancer cells to carboplatin, a very common drug that we use as part of ovarian cancer management. We took that drug from the laboratory into a phase one trial, a trial where we just looked to see what doses were tolerated, and we were able to find some responses in patients with advanced recurrent ovarian cancer. We then did a phase two trial where it appears that many of the women have had responses to the phenoxodiol, and now the FDA is in the process of approving an international study using phenoxodiol, and there'll be 25 centers in the United States that will be participating in that trial, plus a number of centers abroad.
How can a woman access this type of cutting-edge research and clinical study?
Would you like a telephone number?
Sure. Why not? Go for it.
Actually, she can call 203-785-4176, and that's our gynecologic oncology clinic where we see our patients, and they can direct her to the right parties.
And as well, actually, if anyone is a computer savvy, they can go on to the Yale Cancer Center website, and that's yalecancercenter.org.
Peter, let me ask about other targeted therapies. That's sort of a word that we're using in oncology now. Are there any other therapies that you think are going to be very important ones in the future?
Obviously, this is just a field that's beginning to open up. At the last GOG meeting I attended, apparently there's over 150 targeted therapy agents that are now being evaluated by pharmaceutical companies. 50 are being incorporated into ovarian cancer trials. The biggest problem about molecularly targeted therapy is that used alone, it doesn't seem to be very effective in solid tumors like ovarian cancer. So that when used in single agent trials to date, there hasn't been a dramatic response. The best responses appear to be a combination of conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy, the standard chemo we use, in conjunction with molecularly targeted therapy. And there we're seeing much more activity.
Well, actually, we have an email from Tina, who lives in Middletown, and she says here, I'm a 5-year survivor of very early stage ovarian cancer. By that, I'm presuming she meant stage one, and I'm curious to know if I'm at greater risk of developing other types of gynecologic cancer, like cervical cancer.
Well, it's interesting, that question, because we generally see two populations of women. One is the group that gets the glandular cancers, and that includes ovary, uterine cancer, breast, and colorectal cancer. And then the second group gets the squamous cell cancers, and those are lung, cervix, vulvar, vagina, esophagus, those sorts of cancers, often associated, by the way, with cigarette smoking. So I would think that what her risks are for are really the glandular type cancers. If she's a young woman with the early stage disease, she may have had fertility saved. We always worry about the other ovary. We're concerned about the uterus in terms of pelvic reproductive organ cancers.
And as this is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, I would also just emphasize to Tina, especially if she's over the age of 50, that she also is at increased risk for developing colon cancer. And so if she hasn't gone out to get her colonoscopy screening, she should absolutely do that as well.
Thank you. Actually, you know, it is good advice. And I think, Peter, a lot of what you were saying earlier is important for us to remember as well, that all the other types of screening are important. And I think gynecologists have been wonderful throughout the years with their patients in reminding them. If you have questions for Dr. Peter Schwartz or for Healthline, I encourage you to go to our website, yalecancercenter.org, for more information about cancer and about resources available to you. Peter, before we sign off for today's program, what are the key messages that women listening to this program and their families should remember and think about in terms of ovarian cancer?
Sure. In terms of ovarian cancer, one must remember that there are symptoms. They're vague, but they're unexplained, persistent abdominal discomfort, pressure on the bladder causing urinary frequency, sometimes some change in bowel habits. That is something that if it persists for more than 2 weeks, seek help. That's really important. And demand a pelvic exam as part of your evaluation.
Again, for those who are interested in looking about more information for ovarian cancer, they can go to our website. That's yalecancercenter.org. And perhaps, Peter, maybe you could give the phone number again.
203-785-4176.
Well, I'd like to thank Dr. Peter Schwartz for joining us today on Healthline.
Peter, this was a terrific session. Again, thank you. And remember, tune into WTIC News Talk 1080 every Sunday morning at 8:30 a.m. for Healthline with the Yale Cancer Center. Our next program will focus on the role of the immune system to treat cancer, and our special guest will be Dr. Richard Edelson, director of the Yale Cancer Center, and an internationally known expert in the field of cancer immunology and cancer immunotherapy. Until then, this is Dr. Ed Chu.
And Dr. Ken Miller.
From the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
You've been listening to Healthline, a joint venture of Yale Cancer Center and WTIC News Talk 1080. Join us next Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 a.m. for another edition of Healthline on WTIC News Talk 1080.